All right, delighted to be joined by USA legend Brianna Scurry, winner of a World Cup and winner of Olympic medals as well. So you're joining us on the line from the East Coast of the United States. We're in the midst of the World Cup. Maybe just to actually take it all the way back, your career in soccer, it kind of starts when you're 12 and you're signing up for a boys' team.
Yeah, I was sitting in my classroom at 12 years old, and a flyer, piece of paper went around for people to be able to sign up for soccer. I excitedly read the flyer, took it home to my mom and dad, and asked them if I could sign up, and they said, sure. I was playing other sports at the time. Back in those days, we played multiple sports, and my parents were very supportive of anything pretty much that I brought to them in terms of sports, and so signed up for soccer, the only girl on the boys' team, and they, at the time, thought it was a good idea to put the girl in goal. They thought that would be a safe place for me, but as we know now, it's the most dangerous position to play, but I loved it, and really enjoyed playing soccer, and, you know, that's where it all started.
Yeah, and obviously this is Minnesota we're talking about as well, so quite cold in the winters, I'd imagine, as well. And I understand your first love was basketball. Did that kind of inform the way you played in goals?
It did. Basketball and soccer, and goalkeeping in particular, are very similar. Loved playing basketball, always really enjoyed it, really actually liked it more than playing soccer, but as it turned out, as I went on and playing in, you know, in high school and junior high school, I was just a better goalkeeper than I was a soccer player. And growing up, I knew that I would have to get scholarship in order to go to college. And I had a lot of opportunity, more opportunity playing soccer than I did playing basketball. So I went with what I thought I'd be better at.
Yeah, and at that time, of course, the United States women's team had won a World Cup in 1991, but generally the soccer scene in the US was only kind of nascent for both genders in the early 90s. Obviously, USA 94 was coming for the men as well a few years after that. But in terms of opportunities, what was there if you were looking to make a career?
You know, to be completely honest, I didn't actually find out that there was a national team for women's soccer until I went to college. My full intention when I entered college was to play 4 years in college, have a great time, have a great education, and go on to be a lawyer. Post-college, go to law school and then be a lawyer. And my college coach, Jim Rudy, was the one that told me that he thought I was good enough to play on the women's national soccer team, and to which I said I didn't even know there was one. And he said, yeah, you know, they just had a World Cup in 1991, and my freshman year and sophomore year was 1992. And so he said, you know, I think you're good enough to play on this team. I said, you know what, I believe you. At the time, Jim was a brilliant coach, but also a very specialized goalkeeper coach at the time. And he knew talent when he saw it, and he said that I had the talent to play on the national team, and I believed him. And I thought, boy, this is an amazing opportunity. But to be honest with you, I wanted to be an Olympian since I was 8 years old. But soccer as the vehicle, it never really occurred to me at the time. But it just kind of ended up turning out that way. And I'm very grateful it did.
Yeah, and your first cap of what turned out to be 173 caps, and that leads up to 2008. Mm-hmm. So 1994 against Portugal. To maybe have that experience, as you said, you went from not knowing there's a national team, and then you obviously have the national anthem there, and it's the national anthem of your country. So it must be a huge moment of pride, and maybe a bit daunting as well.
It was an amazing moment. You know, it really was. It was a bit daunting too. So the interesting thing about that very first game is I went into training camp before that tournament in November of 1993, and I was number 5 out of 5. Goalkeepers that were at that camp. And by March of 94, which is when that Portugal tournament began, actually, it's so funny, it was so long ago, I was number one by the time that tournament came around. And I remember very distinctively, you know, warming up for that first game and being nervous. And Carla Overbeck, my captain, came up to me and looked me square in my eye and put her hands on my shoulders and said, "You deserve to be here. You belong here." And from that moment on, you know, I was like, yeah, I believe you. And it really settled me down. And I was able to, not only play in that first game in the Algarve Cup, but actually pitch a shutout as well. So that was a really amazing experience, and it's a real testament to the leadership that Carla had.
Yeah, and obviously that long-time dream of being an Olympian, fortunately, as the calendar kind of worked out, the Olympics were happening in the United States, so that it seems like the stars aligned as well, given especially that you won.
They really did align. I tell you what, I tell that story all the time about how I wanted to be an Olympian when I was 8 years old, and I made a sign that I wanted to be in the Atlanta Olympics in 1996 when I was 12 years old. And I sure enough found myself on a team in a sport that was going to have its debut in the Olympic Games in 1996. And as you probably know, usually when a sport is first introduced to the Olympics, it's usually on a trial basis. It's an introductory basis. It's not usually full medal the first time around. And women's soccer was full medal the first time in the Olympic Games in 1996 and happened to be in the United States. And as you also know, the Olympics haven't been in the United States since the Summer Games. And everything just really did align for me, you know, on a team that had an opportunity and a chance at winning the gold medal. And I found myself in the starting spot on that team. And so, you know, it was really something that's truly amazing and nearly impossible became possible.
And am I right, the celebrations were in Athens, Georgia, rather than Atlanta?
Yes, yeah. The soccer tournament within the games is often not actually in the host city. It's a regional tournament, if you will, because the venues are so big. And so many games need to be played. We were playing in Birmingham, Alabama. We were playing in D.C. We played a game in Florida. And we actually never did play in Atlanta. We played our final in Athens, Georgia, which was about an hour and a half away at the University of Georgia.
And, of course, it's all building towards something. So 1999, obviously, the next World Cup comes up and we all know what happened, but we'll get into that, I guess. But there's a rivalry with China here as well, because you seem to meet each other a lot in finals. Obviously, there wasn't any major enmity, but there must have been some sort of rivalry. Or what view did you kind of have of their team?
You know, China back then in the early and mid-90s, they were a huge rival. Norway also was a rival for us, but China was just an amazing technical side. And they really rose to prominence. I think after they had the 91 World Cup in China, their organization and their funding for the women's team, I think, was really taken more seriously. And they had amazing talent, not only technical ability, but also athletic ability. And, you know, when we played against China, we knew we weren't going to have the ball a whole lot, but what we did have as Americans was a fighting spirit, you know, a mentality for winning and athleticism. And we were able to overcome China most of the time when we played them. I mean, we played them so many times and often tied them, but, you know, we're able to really break through against them, but they were a very respected opponent. And they really made a run for, you know, international prominence in those early and mid 90s.
Yeah, and you had had the opportunity, and I suppose you had lost to them in the Algarve Cup just before that World Cup as well. Did that play on the minds when the World Cup final kicks off, or is it the fact, again, as you've said, you played them so many times and generally it can go either way?
You know, we were doing the best we could during the World Cup to focus on our task at hand. But obviously, when you're playing in a World Cup, you see how the other teams are doing. And China was always, you know, going to be an opponent we would either have to meet at some point, we figured, in order to win that tournament in 99. And they were playing amazing soccer. I mean, they were just, you know, running through opponents. They played Norway in the semifinal and just, you know, basically decimated them. And so that week leading up to the final at the Rose Bowl against China was very, you know, we were very focused, very concentrated, very intense, and really looking forward to the challenge and really realized that, you know, China is here to win. So in order for us to be able to beat them, we're going to have to play, you know, a nearly perfect game. And as it turned out, China changed their tactics. They went into a lot more defensive mode in that final against us than they played against Norway in the semifinal before. And that really, I feel, helped us be more competitive and helped us be able to get the opportunities that we did get. And obviously there was no score during that game in the regulation time and in the overtime. But that was a really great game. It was a chess match, you know, 18-18, both teams just trying to wrestle, the advantage away from the other. And it was a truly, a real chess match of a game. And then, of course, the penalty kicks were a whole different story.
Yeah, and you played the biggest role in this as well, because obviously every penalty is scored but one. So we'll just get to that now. And the Chinese kicker was Liu Ying. And I believe you actually, you usually, when you were going up to confront a penalty taker, you wouldn't look at them. Am I right? You actually, just on that one penalty kick, you kind of changed the way you looked at that, or the way you kind of dealt with it, and you actually looked at her.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. My method of operations in a penalty kick shootout was I don't pay any attention to anything except for what I can control. So I wasn't paying attention to my teammates kicking. I actually didn't face them. I had my back to them. I only knew if they made a kick if the crowd responded in a certain way, if they made it or missed it. And I had complete faith in them that they were going to make their kicks. And so I was really just focusing on what I had to do. And so the first two kickers, I normally don't watch anything that they do until I get in the goal and I get set and ready to attend to the situation of where the ball is and how the player is going to kick it. And that third kicker, as I was walking into the goal, something in my mind just said, look. And I looked at her, and it's actually on video. And video actually shows me looking at her, and something in my mind was like, just this is the one. For whatever reason, she, call it divine intervention, call it instinct, call it being in the zone, but for some reason I understood the connection between myself and her was, this is the one I'm going to save. And my only goal for that entire penalty kick shootout was to save one. Just that was the entire thing for me, just to save one. And I knew walking into that goal that she was the one I was going to save.
Yeah, and I noticed a full time after Brandi Chastain kind of scores the clinching penalty for the US, and you've won the World Cup, you're world champions. I didn't really see you in the celebrations, but then the TV footage picks you up running straight to the crowd. It just seemed you made a beeline really for the stands first before coming back to back to your teammates.
Yes, I mean, we had fought so hard and so long, and we had trained so much, and leading into a World Cup, it's years of preparation, and we had actually won that game, and we were just so excited, and I was just so happy and relieved that we actually won everything. And I mean, I forever will always appreciate people who support me. And so that's why I ran into the crowd. I knew where she was, but I didn't know where my parents were. If I'd known where my parents were sitting, I would have ran up to see them. And she was the one I could get to the quickest. So I ran into the stands and was just so happy that we had done it. It was an amazing journey. And, it's really great because we did it on home soil, and little did we know what the impact would be, but we knew the impact was going to be big on all our lives. But it also was very big on women's soccer and women throughout the world.
Yeah, because the attendance records are just smashed the whole way through the tournament, and then obviously the Rose Bowl, a huge arena. Is there was there a sense of a before and after for you? Obviously, as you said, you realise kind of the impact you've made, but I mean, 20 years on, everyone kind of knows about that World Cup final in particular, and like say the Sports Illustrated cover of Brandi Chastain's celebration, there just seemed to be a kind of an iconic moment, an iconic final, and just a crystallization of something?
Yeah, it really was. So the impact of the World Cup was felt all over the world. And I feel like, Brandi's image of her just getting that final penalty kick and taking off her shirt was so natural for her to do. And I think that image of her is just so powerful. Not only for women's soccer, but for women in general. You know, she's fit. You know, she's, you know, essentially the picture of happy and ecstasy and accomplishment and relief all in one. And, you know, that image of our Women's World Cup truly, I think, made it bigger than life. Not just about a soccer tournament, but that image was really meaningful, not only for soccer, but for women empowerment, you know, all over the world.
Yeah, and empowerment as well, you kind of showed it in another way as well, not long after that tournament, in terms of the collective bargaining agreement, because obviously when you're taking on an organization like the US Federation, as players, I'm sure it is daunting, but you did it, you boycotted a few games, and you were able to, I suppose, stand up for your rights. And I do understand that you are quite proud of that, especially in particular.
Yeah, in particular, the platform on the stage we had, we can do more than footballers. And the women, you know, we understood and knew that we had to always fight for just to be equal. And we realized that because we had high visibility, because it was an international, because we were successful, because we were winning championships and bring glory to soccer in this country, and to bring the fact that all these people were watching in soccer that they wouldn't watch with soccer anyway, that we could, you know, create change. And it wasn't just about creating change for players that were playing at that time. It was about creating change for the players that come behind us. It was about inspiring the Soccer Federation, an organization that is supposed to grow the game of soccer in the United States for everyone, not just for men and boys, but for women and girls too, for everybody. Made a decision that, you know what, we can help move the needle on this, and we're willing to do what is difficult and be unified in it. And I think, and the reason it continues to be 20 years later is because we're unified, and that's why it actually works.
Yeah. Something else you've spoken about, it's the concussion issue, which I think people are starting to understand it a little bit more, whereas before it wasn't something people touched on, but there have been a number of high profile cases, and I know that's kind of how your career ended. It was it happened during a match in April 2010, and you know, it's obviously a hugely serious issue. We have a former player here in Ireland who had to retire due to the headaches and everything it caused, Kevin Doyle. He was actually playing for Colorado Rapids, I think, at the time. But can you just talk us back through that incident and maybe how you realized something serious had actually happened to you?
Sure. I mean, you know, as a goalkeeper in particular, and then also as a footballer, you often have times where, you know, you get knocked in the head, and normally in sport you're encouraged to shake it off, get a glass of water, or, you know, just kind of fight your injury if you have one. And on that particular, I was, you know, playing for the Washington Freedom, which is the league team that I played for there. And we were playing a game against Philadelphia. And I was playing in this game, and it was a routine low ball on the left-hand side of me. And as I was going to get the ball, the opposing team try to, like, you know, nip in front of me and try to get a toe in and get the ball. And instead, she ended up hitting me in the side of my head with my feet. And I never saw her coming. And so I feel like, you know, because I never saw her coming, and because it was a side of my head, which is why it was so severe, even though the hit itself doesn't seem all that, you know, demonstrative, but the impact was huge on me. You know, we both bundled over as she ran to me, and the referee didn't even call a foul, which is very interesting, considering it completely changed my life, trajectory of my life. Mm. It wasn't even a foul. And, you know, I played the half and at the halftime, and as I was walking off the pitch, you know, veering to my left, the trainer came out and asked me if I was okay. To a degree, I knew it wasn't okay, but it wouldn't be okay for a very, very long time. And, you know, with a concussion, you know, subside after a few days, maybe a week or so, you know, the symptoms go away, but mine weren't going away. They were getting worse and worse, and I had aches and sensitivities to light and sound and motion, you know, insomnia. Started to get anxiety and depression. These are all things, the lack of focus. And I knew something was really wrong, especially with the lack of focus and anxiety, because I had never felt anything like focus. Obviously, if I can all people holding their breath, I have incredibly amount of focus. And so I think there was something very wrong, and the weeks turned into months, into years. A very long time before I got any, relief from that. And finally, 3 years later, had a surgery. Occipital nerves, which is a nerve behind your ears. And I had surgery done in December of 2013, year of therapy. So it took a very to recover, and I decided to be an advocate. During that time, because I went on mean something, and it is the first years of my life where things were horrible.
Yeah, and I know the likes of Taylor Twellman, for example, have spoken out as well about that very issue, because it is very serious. And even reading through some of the, I think your surgeon Ivica Dukic had to like pull out, kind of remove pea-sized balls of damaged tissue, which when you read that, it seems really, really serious. And obviously that was contributing to the headaches as well. I suppose a final point maybe before we let you go, obviously the World Cup is ongoing, and there's been a debate on both sides of the Atlantic about the size of goals and whether it should be made smaller for the women's game. A lot of the people we've spoken to feel that's unnecessary. As a goalkeeper, do you think that's something that should just be pushed to the side as an argument?
Yeah, I actually read that, and I laughed out loud. That was ridiculous. And then I read that. It was, you know, Emma Hayes, who actually know pretty well. She was my coach before that concussion occurred. And I get her argument, but I don't agree with it. At this point, you know, want equality, have to have equality. Want equality with pay and with treatment, with marketing dollars, with respect, then I don't see how we ask for that and also ask for some. This doesn't fit.
Yeah.